Welcome to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Hulings Fund for Visual Artists. The Clark Hulings Fund exists to provide training, introductions, and funding to working artists, to turn working artists into thriving artists. I'm Daniel DeGree, your host. Our guest today is Carla Crawford. Now, Carla creates powerful figurative paintings made in the classical tradition. Her latest work is inspired by displaced migrants. She paints incredibly detailed portraits to document their stories. She also draws inspiration from her students at Academy of Art University in San Francisco, where she teaches painting and drawing. Carla is a 2015 Clark Hulings Fund Business Accelerator Grant finalist. Carla, we know you're an artist, of course. Can you take a minute to tell us a little bit more in your own words about yourself?
Yeah, thanks, Daniel, for having me. It's great to be with you guys today. So as you mentioned, I'm a figurative painter, and I work in a classical style. I was trained in Italy and in New York in kind of the atelier system, where you work with a small group of students with kind of one master painter and focus mostly on the figure. You know, I spent in my training about 8 hours a day in front of the figure for about 3 years. And that's really what I'm interested in my work today. So I'm really focused on the portrait and the figure. And I'm really interested in kind of quiet, small scenes. That's really what I focus on as an artist. And again, using those classical techniques of traditional painting. I work in oil paint, and I just love kind of the tradition of oil painting.
Well, to that end, congratulations on your recent award of exceptional merit at the Portrait Society of America's 18th annual The Art of the Portrait.
Oh, thank you.
But I wonder, can you tell us a little bit more about that event and why it's important to you?
Yeah, so the portrait competition is just such a fun weekend. It's all painters together, and it's, again, a big exposition of portraiture in the country today, so national portraiture. And it's just so interesting, so wonderful to get together with so many artists. It's 800 people, 900 people, and it's wonderful to just be able to spend a weekend talking about the craft of painting, you know. There's so few times when I can just spend a weekend just talking about varnish with people, right? But you can get together and really talk shop with everyone. So that was a wonderful experience, something that I was really happy to be a part of. And just being together with a lot of artists can, be something that you take a lot of inspiration from as you come back to your studio.
That's a great scene. I love the thought of a bunch of artists gathered around talking varnish.
Of course.
I saw Brian Setzer from the Stray Cats. You know, you poke him and start talking about amplifiers, he can go on forever about that stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Right. You have to talk shop.
So it's, tools of the trade. Exactly. Well, now, most of your work is in the classical tradition. So what appeals to you about classical technique with modern subject matter? Is that part of your branding strategy?
Oh, that's such an interesting question. Now, I don't think that I really came up with a branding strategy when I started out as an artist, right? I think that's not exactly what draws you to being an artist. At least that wasn't my case. You know, I grew up, I just loved working with my hands. I think like a lot of people, right? I loved painting. I loved drawing. And I was lucky that I was from a very supportive family that, they didn't question whether I was going to study art, but it was more where. And they were very supportive as I kind of figured that out, right? Because it's never just one institution or one teacher, right? I think that you have to kind of figure that out for yourself. So I started out, I went to UC Davis, I studied, I went on exchange to Italy, and I was really in pretty contemporary institutions, you know, conceptual art, very stylish right now in the art world, and that was a lot of what I focused on. But when I went abroad to Italy, again, I was studying at the Academy of Art in Bologna and in Venice, I spent 2 years there, and while these were very contemporary institutions, you're just surrounded by classical painting all the time. You know, you walk down the street, there's a fresco on the wall, you go into the church, there's these fabulous paintings, it's just surrounding you. It's not something that you have to go to a museum to see. And I think when I was there, it was just a very formative time in my life. I really fell in love with classical painting, and it's hard to find. It's hard to find people who teach it. And typically, you have to go to small ateliers, again, to find that kind of training, to find, again, an individual master painter that takes on a few students where you're intensely studying anatomy, you know, the physics of light, how to layer paint, these traditional drawing methods. Those are all things that I was really interested in, really the craft of painting. And again, it comes back to that idea of working with your hands that I found just so appealing when I was a kid that I still love now. But I think that in my work, that idea of bringing classical techniques to more contemporary subject matter it's not that it started out as a branding idea. It's just kind of what my own personal story was, where I had started out studying at more contemporary conceptual institutions and then kind of did a 180 and spent these years studying the classical techniques of painting. And really, they just come together in my work. So yeah, the business side of things is something that, again, it's a whole other skill, right? And branding and thinking of my work from that perspective is something that came after, probably, from what I was just naturally interested in.
Now, you know, we don't usually get a lot of classical realist artists applying to our grant.
Mm-hmm.
And we were really excited when you applied. But why do you think that is? Why do you think so few reach out to us to become part of our Business Accelerator program?
Right. Yeah, that's a great question. It is kind of this thing where there's not a lot of crossover between the worlds, right? Probably because studying realistic painting, studying these traditional methods, is kind of this countercultural choice in a way, right? It's not very stylish right now in the art world. So I think that sometimes there's not a lot of crossover, and there really should be, right? Because again, there's so much in the art world at large to learn from and grow from, and cross-pollination is always good and interesting. But yeah, it tends to be that the realist world tends to be a little bit more isolated. I don't know why that is.
Well, I want to shift for a second and just ask you a little bit then about the other side of it, because of course there's the classical realist technique and then there's the modern subject matter. So other than just the opportunity of what we're seeing on the nightly news, why is your current focus on migrants, displaced persons, and refugees?
Yeah, so I guess the long answer to that is that I had just finished a solo show in 2014. And the museum Casa de los Tios in Granada, Spain, and then it traveled to my gallery, the Winslope Gallery in California. And the work had sold, and, you know, I had put so much energy into this show. It was, you know, 4 years of work, just an incredible kind of effort on my part to kind of bring this project to completion. And then it was over, and I had the experience of coming back to the studio after my first solo shows and having the blank walls, right? And you have to start over. And so I think it comes back to that idea for me of having it be a sustainable practice. Obviously, I want to be working as an artist for my whole life. This is a process that I want to go through many times, but it's again, daunting once you've had this big project that's been brought to completion. Start over and to again find something that not only engages you emotionally but engages you intellectually and creatively as well. So at that time, it was last summer, I was seeing, like everyone, these images in the news and reading about this story of refugees pouring into Europe, and I was just really captivated by it. And so I started thinking about it. You know, I was seeing the images every day. I think in 2013, it was the first year that there are more refugees worldwide since World War II, more than at the end of World War II. And I think at the end of 2015, there's 65 million, right? That's one in every 113 people on the planet is a refugee, right? So I really think of this as a global story. I really think of it as not just a story in the Middle East or Europe, but obviously we're dealing with it and the ramifications of this story here in this country. And I live in Oakland, right, which is a very international city. And we have, my husband and I have worked with refugees. We've known people. And I just was interested in focusing on that in my work. But I don't really, I think this is such a massive story. It's such a huge story. But I don't really deal with grandiose or kind of epic or monumental themes in my work. I have very quiet, kind of simple, intimate work, because that's really the subject of my work. So I was really interested. This is really a story about my face in the human face to tell a story. I was just interested in painting simple portraits of individuals. Because, you know, we all hear the statistics. We hear the numbers. We hear big news stories, but it's hard to connect sometimes. It's hard to really understand the gravity of it in some way, or the consequences of it. But connecting with a face, connecting with an individual story, it somehow brings things home, at least for me, you know? So I started reaching out to the International Rescue Committee, which is a huge organization. They resettle refugees all across the country. And I had to go through a lot of red tape, but they have been great to work with, and they've connected me with several families that I'm working with now.
This may not have been part of your thought process, but because I've spent a little bit of time studying this, it's a side question out of curiosity. You know, we have this this current migrant situation. And eventually what happens when, you know, you reach a critical mass of these numbers, it's sort of like Turkish people in France or the nation of Israel, you end up with a permanent diaspora. You end up with it not being a migration anymore, but the migration, you know, people stop moving and the place they land becomes their new home. And if they land there in large enough numbers, then they're a diaspora. They are a permanently displaced people who now have a new environment. And I wonder if after you, you know, sort of thoroughly explored these themes of migration to your satisfaction, if you're going to then look at permanent diasporas as sort of a next step.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I'm really interested, again, in the personal and in the individual, right? And I'm most interested in the refugee situation where I live and the migrant situation where I live, because, again, California is incredibly international. And it's really, again, a way of exploring my hometown, my where I live right now, right? So that, what you're talking about, which is, again, a huge crisis globally, we're not seeing so much in this country. So I would have to travel to do that. I'm open to that because, again, I am really interested in this story. But it's not on my radar right now, I would say. I'm most interested in kind of exploring the people that I see every day in my community.
So Carla, you know, how profitable or saleable from a business standpoint is that particular thematic direction? Or if it's not profitable, then how do you juggle your inspiration with the need to earn money?
Right. Yeah, that's such a good question again. So it is an interesting thing. I don't always try and guess how saleable an art piece is going to be when I start a project, simply because it's a hard thing to guess. Sometimes I think in my life, you know, you hear these things like red still lifes are what's hot right now. You need to paint all red still life. You're going to make so much money. But then no one buys those or whatever. You know, it's hard to predict necessarily what is going to sell. And sometimes I've been really surprised that things that I wouldn't have guessed would sell have sold. So for myself, I find that the best work tends to sell itself. If I'm doing really great work, regardless of the subject material, it tends to sell. That doesn't mean that you don't have to kind of do the hustle finding the right venue to sell a piece or the right audience. But I think I try and find for myself, it's a, I get better work out of myself if I really paint to my interests. And if I am passionate about the work, if I'm really interested emotionally and intellectually in the work. So right now I'm kind of in the creative phase of the project. I'm you know, meeting people, working in the studio, painting people, hearing stories. And I have been approached about showing it in several different spots, but I haven't really decided where the show is going to end up once it's ready to be shown. I think that's something, for me, I tend to, it's two different brains, two different modes of thinking, where one is the studio brain, where you're kind of thinking, you're in the creative mindset, right? And the other one's the business mindset. And it tends to come later for me, honestly. And it's something that I'm continuing to kind of hone and learn because it's a different skill. But I try to not let that come into the studio necessarily, because when you do, at least for me, I mean, of course, you want the work to sell, you want the work to be seen, you want it to be successful, but that's not my core motivation, if that makes sense. I want my core motivation to be about what truly is engaging me in front of the canvas, and that's really why I show up in the studio every day.
Well, you know, it's interesting you talk about this. You know, we do, obviously, a lot of business strategy at the Clark Healings Fund. That's really what we're about, business strategy for artists. And, you know, it's important, obviously, to believe in your work. I went to a local place yesterday and they had discontinued something they were well known for. It was one of the main reasons to go to that place. And they discontinued because they said we're not selling enough. And I felt so bad because I thought, you know, but you really did that like nobody else. It was one of your differentiators. And so I think I would have found new ways to market it differently versus simply discontinue it and go to something a little more generic that, sure, people are buying, but everyone else is also selling. And as I thought about that issue, I thought about talking with you today that, you know, we ask this question a lot, you know, the market versus the muse at Clark Healings Fund. But maybe it's not just passion versus the rationality of it, but maybe it's both. I remember our earlier podcast, we talked with Brandon Kralik and Wadi White, some very, you know, successful artists who, I forget which one of them, or maybe both, said what they do is you, and what they recommend is do the thing you care about
follow your passion, but you, in order to make that work, in order to make it based on that, you have to put the authenticity and the integrity into it. You have to really take it seriously so that you can really just do that. And if you're not going to, then it won't work anyway. And so I guess my question for you is, where is that authenticity and integrity for you? What's the secret that makes your commitment make this thing go?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Authenticity is so important in the work. And again, I do think that that's something that if you don't have that, it's harder to, again, make a business out of it. Because again, when you naturally believe in your work and what you're doing, I think the right venue, the right audience, you can find it. So for me, I'm just naturally drawn to portraiture. I'm drawn to traditional painting, classical painting. And it's not important to me whether that's in style or out of style. That's something that just has captured my intellectual and creative attention. And that's what I want to be doing in the studio. It's why I want to keep showing up in the studio. And again, I'm really motivated by that individual story, the power of a face to tell a story. And I do find that this project, yeah, just keeps me coming back, that there's just so much there in terms of these individual stories that I can engage with on the canvas.
Well, let me ask you one more question before we sort of go to the business side of your work. And that is, why did you apply for the Clark Ewlings Fund Business Accelerator Grant? Is what it has been what you expected?
So I applied for model fees because, again, I'm working with a lot of models and I want to pay these people fairly. That was something that I wanted help with. I also really appreciate that there's this training with Clark Ewlings of the business side of your art career. Again, it's a different skill. It's a different way of thinking, and it's not where I was trained in. I was trained in layering paint, in anatomy, in, you know, underpainting and traditional drawing methods. Running a business and learning how to, again, make your art business sustainable, that's a whole other skill. So it is wonderful to have extra support in that regard and training in that regard, because, again, it's something that you have to kind of piece together yourself, as is often the case in the arts. So it was something that I wanted to get involved with for those reasons, just because it is a whole other aspect of my art career that, honestly, I love being in the studio. I love painting. I'm not a natural businesswoman, I would say. So it's wonderful to get the training. You know, you can learn it, but it's a whole other skill set. So I've loved just being able to participate in the community, taking part in the classes, the business support. It's so helpful, and I do think that it's something that I need that training as I'm moving forward.
Well, that's good to hear. You know, of course, I just got off a call with some of the upcoming instructors today, and it's such an exciting program, the Business Accelerator Program. For those that haven't looked at the details at clarkewlingsfund.org, there are workshops for marketing for artists, business strategy, communications for artists, legal contract and negotiation issues, the financial side, pricing, sales, all of the aspects that allow a working artist to really thrive by professionalizing the business side of their practice. So it's really exciting for those of us involved in the design of the program and the education, as well as I think your sentiments are representative of the current participants. The Clark Ewlings Fund delivers podcast courses like this at the pleasure of our audience. That means if you're finding value in what you're hearing, a gift of $15 per month would be a welcome and appropriate way to sponsor this show's ongoing broadcast. Know also that a portion of our funding goes to deliver direct education to artists who've demonstrated a clear, achievable plan for transforming their businesses into self-sustaining and thriving ones that fill the world with art. Share this commitment with us now at clarkewlingsfund.org/thrive. That's clarkewlingsfund.org/thrive. We'd certainly appreciate it. Now, Carla, you built an art career from the ground up. What were the challenges and what went into doing that?
Yeah, that's such a great question. I mean, I think that it's such a funny thing. I always tell my students, there's no set path in the arts, right? You always have to find your own way, whether it's figuring out where you're going to get your training, who you're going to study with, and then figuring out the whole gallery scene, figuring out, again, you know, how you're going to sell your work, who your clients are going to be, again, figuring out what your subject material is going to be. There's no set path, right? So we all have to do it for ourselves. And again, that's why support is so important, why an organization like this is so important, I think. For me, again, I think a huge piece of that was figuring out what I wanted to do and focusing, again, on where I wanted to get my training. So that was a huge challenge, which I've already talked about. And then, you know, contacting galleries, getting into galleries, figuring out where your niche is going to be in the art world is another huge challenge. So I work with two galleries now, who I both love. I've been very lucky. And, you know, it's a continually kind of unfolding process as I learn more and more about what it means to be a sustainable artist, do this for my whole life, right? Because, again, there are always those moments in a successful art career where you've sold everything, you've had your show, and you have to start over. So I'm still learning. I think I'm still piecing that together. Again, there's no set path. And, yeah, I'm still moving forward in that regard.
Well, I want to ask you, and you commented earlier that, you know, you were following your passion more than the news, but still shifting gears and just looking at it as a business strategy. You followed a news cycle in order to create a theme, i.e. migrant populations. So are you planning to keep up this method of generating new ideas for art direction? Meaning, are you planning to continue to follow news cycles as a possible way to sort of comment on the culture through your art?
To me, I'm most interested in portraiture, right? And again, that power of the human face to tell a story. So I don't see myself necessarily following the news cycle, because that's not really what this work is about. This is about individual stories and stories that I find compelling. So that's really what I find interesting. And again, these are stories that are unfolding around me that I'm seeing every single day, because Oakland is a big resettlement area for refugees. So it's more, I think, not so much following the news cycle, but just following what I find interesting in my daily life that I'm seeing around me. And that's really something that I think continues to be an inspiration to me in my work moving forward. And it just so happened that what I was seeing in my daily life was reflected in the global news. So that was really more of a coincidence of why I found that interesting.
Let me ask you, how do you plan for unintended lags in your sales? So for instance, do you have a plan for ensuring that your business is sustainable and that you can create marketable art for a lifetime? Or is it, I'm going for the passion, and I assume that if I do that with the integrity we talked about earlier, it's not even a consideration. Is there something there, in other words, that you must plan for?
No, I think you're right. It goes back to kind of, again, having two mindsets. I think when you create, you try and create with that authentic kind of spirit where you really are just engaging with what intrigues you. But then, of course, you do have to kind of switch mindsets and think in that business mode. Again, if you want it to be sustainable, if you want to be able to do work that can sustain itself. Your question about lagging art sales, that does happen. Sometimes things sell like hotcakes and sometimes they don't. So I think for me, of course, there's a lot of strategy. You can kind of switch things around, pull things out of one gallery, put them into another gallery, maybe move a painting out of one location, put it into a traveling show. Sometimes it's all about just finding the new audience and finding the right audience for a painting to move. And then, of course, doing studio sales, kind of generating your own publicity. Those are all ways that I think can make paintings go, that can make things pick up in terms of sales. But of course, there are times, you know, it's kind of unpredictable, as I said before. You don't always know what's going to sell. So I think for me, it's come down to, again, keeping things moving, not letting things stay in one place for too long, and trying to get that momentum in your kind of sales area. And again, it is a different mindset, right? I try not to think about that when I'm in the studio, but it is something that I do try and strategize about when I'm in my business mindset. So yeah, that kind of comes down to my strategy there.
Well, now, you're also very active as a teacher, traveling, as a mother and wife. How do you do all of these things and still operate the business side of being a studio artist in the first place?
Yeah, well, it's a juggle, of course, right? Like anyone, there's all these pieces, and I don't call it a balance, because I think there's probably no such thing as balance. Instead, it's a juggle, and sometimes, you know, you get everything working beautifully, and sometimes all of the juggling balls are on the ground, right? But, of course, I have a fabulous and supportive husband. That's a huge help. And I have a very flexible teaching schedule, which, again, is a huge help. It's very compatible with my studio life. And I find that teaching, it just naturally leads into my work into the studio. I want to keep teaching for my entire career, because I really do feel like it just gives so much. It's a way for me to verbalize techniques. It's a way for me to kind of verbally work through methods that we use in the studio. It gives me the social element. And then I find my students' work inspiring, too. it's this natural, I think, companion to my work in the studio where I'm by myself. I'm more introspective. I tend to kind of be a little bit more withdrawn, and then I get to come out of the studio and go teach. And it's just very life-giving. I think both of the processes kind of feed into each other. Yeah, I find that teaching is one of the ways that I keep staying inspired in the studio for sure. And again, it's not easy to maintain a balance, but I think of it as a juggle, and they do kind of a family life, teaching, studio life. They all kind of feed into each other and inspire each other. And yeah, I find that it all works out.
Well, we are actually going to ask you in the third segment of our show about arts education in particular. But on the business side, you know, you've curated a show in Italy. And we want to ask you, you know, what are the different challenges between curating a show of other artists' works versus preparing your own works for, say, a gallery exhibition?
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, I think we tend to be more critical of our own work. At least I tend to be more critical of my own work. So curating a show for someone else, it's just such a joyful experience. It's so wonderful to watch it come together and to see the different visual themes kind of coming out in the show. I was very lucky to be a part of that show. It was the Wayne Thiebaud and Giorgio Morandi show at the Morandi Museum in Italy. It's just two amazing artists, one that's younger than the other. You see the influence of Morandi on Thiebaud. And it's just a wonderful, it was such a wonderful experience to see both of those artists and how they'd worked over their entire lives. These are both men who worked, Wayne Thiebaud is still working, he's in his 90s. Giorgio Morandi worked for his entire life. And again, just seeing how they have been and were interested by the subject material that they were interested by. It wasn't necessarily what was fashionable. It wasn't necessarily what was trendy at the time, but they had, again, that real authenticity to the work. And yeah, I just think that curating gives you that wonderful perspective to bring back into the studio. What it means to have sustainable interest, to be able to do this for your whole life, to have the authentic interest in what you're interested in. So that show was very, very formative for me. It was a wonderful experience. I was so lucky to be able to work with Alessia Masi and the University of California in Bologna, Italy. Just to see these two great artists, the influences that one had on the other, and to see again how that came out in their work in their own way, in their own style. And yeah, that did absolutely influence me. I don't know if it's necessarily something that I thought about when I was putting together my own show. Well, I guess, you know, it was probably something that I thought about when I was putting together my own show, really thinking about it, those themes of being interested in what I was interested in.
Well, let me ask you this. So did you develop relationships that came out of curation that are still beneficial to you, not just from an inspirational or friendship standpoint, but beneficial to you in sort of a networking and business manner?
Yeah, I would say absolutely there's relationships that I got from curating that still inspire me in the studio today. From a business standpoint, I don't know that I think about those relationships in that regard, but just from a creative standpoint, absolutely. Wayne Thiebaud was my professor. Again, I co-curated that show at the Morandi Museum. He's a huge inspiration to me in my work, simply of what it means to be a painter who works for over 70 years in the studio. He has been interested in the material that he's been interested in, whether it's been fashionable or not. And he's just a fabulous painter, a fabulous human being. People at the Morandi Museum, such wonderful people, very inspirational to me in the studio. I do, of course, still talk to them and network with them about my show and its personal friendships. I think that it is so important to have those experiences where you do see how the art world works, how a show is pulled off like that, and all the people that go into making a show like that work. So it's a very enriching experience for me, for sure.
Well, so are you more likely to meet a variety of people in the art industry, gallerists, museum curators, and other people through doing a show like that, say more so than doing a show of just your own work?
Yeah, that's so interesting that you asked that. Yeah, I do think that that is the case. I definitely came into contact with so many people, Italians and Americans, that I probably wouldn't have come into contact with just through my own work. You know, and again, these are two world-class artists, so they're really both heroes of mine. So it's just a dream to be working with so many people who have been influential to them, important to them. And it was just a big experience for me, a growing experience for me as an artist.
So that's fascinating, because it implies there are some sort of business networking potential opportunities there, but also, you know, you talked about almost getting some mentorship value out of it, and I'm sure that you provided a little bit of that as well. So all of that, you know, we would consider part of sort of the business exchange. If you've been finding value in what you're hearing, a gift of $15 per month lets you sponsor this show's ongoing broadcast. Visit clarkhealingsfund.org/thrive to continue bringing content like this to the public. We'd certainly appreciate it. Now, Carla, as we shift into the last segment of our show, I want to ask you a bit about arts education. And I want to preface that by sort of going through your background so that people have some sense of what your experience is. So you have a BA from the University of California in art with an exchange year in Italy. You have a graduate degree in art education at San Francisco State University. You taught art in public schools while studying at the Atelier School of Classical Realism in Oakland. You did a 3-year course of study in anatomy, portraiture, and classical painting at the Grand Central Academy of Art. From 2012 to 2013, you spent the year in Spain making master copies at the Prado Museum. You teach painting and drawing at the Academy of Art University in San Francisco. And of course, you're involved in the Business Accelerator Grant Program with the Clark Healings Fund, which includes a bevy of workshops throughout the year designed to help working artists become thriving artists. So clearly, you are very passionate about arts education, both your own and the education of others. So first question I want to ask is, how pivotal is education to your career success and to that of the artists that you know of?
Yeah, well, I think that as a painter, your studies are never done, right? It's just, there's so much to kind of engage with, to study with. It's such a rich tradition. There's so many methods, so many techniques. I find for myself, I'm just endlessly interested. There's so many things to learn. So I still do museum copies where I, again, find a master painting that I want to copy. And there's things that you can learn from the master, like that year we spent in Spain, where I wanted to do that at the Prado, simply because it just never ends. There's just so much back and forth between the teaching and student relationship. And for me, between going in to teach at the academy and my studio here, it's just a very enriching process, I think. Yeah, so I think, as I mentioned, there's just no set path in the arts. And there's no one institution, there's no one master that can teach it all to you. So I find for myself in getting that training that you have to kind of pick and choose. You have to go out and figure out where you're going to get the skills you want to have. And again, there's such a wide range of techniques, a wide range of methods. You really have to work quite a bit to pinpoint what it is that you want to do and who can teach you that, or what group of people can teach you that. So it's simply one of those things that in the arts you have to piece it together for yourself. And then in terms of teaching, as I mentioned earlier, it just is something that continually enriches my work in the studio. Just a natural kind of fit, I think, because my students are young. They're so excited. It's so interesting to watch the breakthroughs that they make. They still come up with approaches to work that I haven't thought of. And it just is naturally something that I can bring back to the studio and feel, you know, invigorated coming back to my work in the studio when I'm ready to get back to my own painting.
Well, now it's interesting because you're describing art education in terms of the education about art technique. And I'm always curious, you know, do you feel, was the business side of it part of the educational experience you had as well, as it would be for many other professions that obviously need to become economically viable in the world? You know, they'll teach you the basics of, you know, like a mini MBA, they'll teach you the business side of it so you can be self-sustaining. Was that part of your background in education? Or if not, why do you think that may be lacking in arts education today to such a degree?
Yes, absolutely. It was not covered. It was very lacking in all of my training. I think that it's lacking in education. And that's, you know, in most institutions, I say, but that is definitely the case. I think it's lacking just because, again, there's so much else to kind of deal with. It's such a different mindset that it just tends to be overlooked. And it is a really important part of our training. I think that that is really true. How, again, are you going to sustain yourself as an artist? We all want to spend all our time in the studio, but how are you going to sustain that over your lifetime such an important thing to be able to master. And again, it's a completely different skill from what you're doing in the studio, but it's essential. So that definitely was very lacking. And it is, you know, for almost every single artist I know, that was something that was not covered in their training, regardless of the institution that they went to. And so it's something that artists have to piece together for themselves. For me, I've pieced it together. I mean, things like this are wonderful, right, where you actually get direct teaching. But they're very unusual. I think a lot of how I piece together how I run my business has been advice from other artists, which is, of course, priceless. People who have gone before you and tell you, you know, how they've made it work. And again, you have to piece it together for yourself. It's not a, you know, a formula that you can plug anything into. You have to figure out how you're going to tailor it to make it work for you. But again, it is that training that I think artists need to seek out. And it's so important. And you can't just wait for it to happen just because, again, it's not covered in most programs. It's not covered in most institutions. And it's essential to making your practice sustainable.
Well, of course, you know, you're singing our song. This is clearly part of the mission of the Clark Hewlings Fund. We find sort of the absence of education that makes people economically viable in the art world as artists. We find that lack of education rather appalling. And so we're filling that gap by trying to pair expert instructors with people that are working as artists but really want it to be a permanent part of the of fortifying the economy. So I'm really glad that you sort of preached our gospel for us. That was really nice. So I want to ask you then, you talked about how teaching feeds your craft. And I wonder about the ways in which you engage as a learner. So what process did you undertake to understand whether or not an apprenticeship, residency, or an atelier was a good fit for you and for your goals? Can you sort of walk us through the process of that decision making?
Right. So for me, I think what helped me make that decision was you figure out what are the skills that you want. Right? You look at the work that you absolutely love, that you want to be doing, and you figure out what skills do I need to have to be able to be doing that work. And then for me, I followed to where I was going to be able to get those skills. So I, you know, decided not to do a traditional MFA program simply because, again, I wouldn't be getting those figurative skills that I really wanted to have. I wanted to spend 8 hours a day in front of the figure, really doing that intensive anatomy, study of the physics of light, studies of traditional drawing methods. I couldn't necessarily get that in a more traditional program or a more, you know, normal program. So to me, that was how I decided where I wanted to study. I figured out what are the skills that I want to have, and then who can actually teach me those skills, or what group of people could teach me those skills. And I think that's what everyone has to do, because you can, you know, get in the most prestigious school in the world, but you may come out without the skills that you want to have to do the work that you want to do. And so, again, it really does depend on what is it that you want to be doing, what are the skills that you need to have to be able to do that work.
So have residencies and participation in ateliers also been important to your business development? Have they, in other words, taught you things that were necessary to make you economically viable, as well as sort of what you wanted to learn in terms of artistic technique?
Mm-hmm. Well, residencies are wonderful because they just give you the time, right? That's what a residency is. It just gives you the time to focus 100% on your work. So when I've been able to have that opportunity, again, it's that wonderful retreat into just focusing 100% on the work, not having any distractions, not having anyone that has any demands on you. You don't have to teach in that period of time. So residencies are wonderful for that regard. And of course, you make connections during residencies as well. I think studying at ateliers, what studying in an atelier gives you is, again, it gives you contact to a master artist. And for me, I think why that was helpful, when I worked with Jacob Collins in his studio, and I spent a year again in his private studio and 3 years working with him in his atelier, it gives you, when you work in the private studio of a master artist like that, it gives you insight into the whole artistic process, right? So you're seeing not only the finished product in a gallery or in a museum, but you're seeing the initial stages of that painting. You're seeing the initial drawing. You're seeing the transfer to the canvas. You're seeing, you know, the underpainting. You're seeing the, you know, final pass in layers. And you're seeing the reworking there as well, and how much time that takes. And then when you're in the private studio of an artist like that, you also see some of the business side of things. So you see, again, clients stopping by, you see people coming and going kind of out of the studio, you see the networking happening. And so all of that is incredibly helpful. I mean, there's nothing like being able to see an established artist doing that from the inside.
Now, let me just pivot for a second and ask you specifically about competitions. So why not focus solely on gallery representation or just solo shows? Why participate in competitions in the first place?
Yeah, I think that competitions, it's not my primary focus, but it can, again, give you that extra spark of energy. Just because, again, you're seeing lots of different people work at something like the Portrait Society competition. You're getting to go away for the weekend with 800 different painters. And just the conversations that you have, the networking that you're able to do, you know, the different people that you meet, it's very inspiring to come back to the studio with that. I do think that it can be kind of a powerful tool at times.
You know, I think if I could kind of, at the risk of summarizing sort of what you've been saying the last couple of questions, you know, I think there's sort of an experience level. Everybody knows about you. Malcolm Gladwell talked about it. You get 10,000 hours at a given thing, whether it's playing the piano or engineering, and you sort of develop a sixth sense about that thing. You become a bit of an expert at it, or you're really viable, say, as an artist. But it's not just about that. You're describing sort of another component that you also need lots and lots of data inputs, lots of a sense. I mean, in some fields, it'd be competitive knowledge. In a field like construction, you know, building a couple of sheds is not enough. You do enough work that after a few years, you have a real knowledge of materials and what their properties are and how they interact with each other. In math, it's the same way. You have to really do enough math that you develop a math sense before you can do something like becoming a computer programmer. And with you as an artist, you're really describing, it sounds like, with all of these different data inputs, with all of your educational endeavors and quite a few, you know, just all the things that we described earlier, you're feeding yourself and saying that it's necessary to feed yourself lots of examples of other people's work, not just from a competitive standpoint, but from the standpoint of knowing how work is done, knowing what's possible, and being able to sort of bend that. So it's almost like spending the hours at the piano studying the classical compositions so that then you can finally pivot and do your own in a way that's really not the same, but substantive. So is that a fair summary, or am I off a bit?
No, I think that's exactly right. You know, I think that I used to think when I was younger that there were shortcuts, right? But there really are no shortcuts. It really is putting in those hours. And yeah, I think having those relationships with artists, it's not a competitive thing. It's that camaraderie. It's, again, seeing what's possible. It's having that network of people, because so much of business success in the arts comes from fellow artists, you know, recommendations, or if I can't do this commission, I recommend it to somebody else, or, you know, just introducing people to other people, gallery owners or editors or, you know, curators. So much of it comes from our support of each other within the arts that I really do love those experiences where I can have the support of artists, meet more artists, and again, network together and support each other in our work in the studio. And it is so important to see those examples of people who've kind of gone before you and are making it work. There's no two stories that are the same. Everyone has to piece it together for themselves. It can be very overwhelming. So those examples can be very helpful.
I really like what you're saying. I spent a couple of years doing business networking, and, you know, it wasn't just about trying to find business prospects. It was about being able to give powerful referrals when someone would be a fit for a given project, and maybe you wouldn't be, or the project just isn't what you do, but you know somebody, and being able to receive them also, but also learning from each other, each other's methods and processes. I think it's really true what you're saying of any profession. So I really love that. I want to sort of wind down our show with a few fun questions, and they'll be focused a little bit on business, but also on you. So I want to ask you, where do you see yourself, Carla, in 10 years?
Okay, so this question, I think that for me, I, of course, want to be still working in the studio, still showing up every day. So the main thing is that in 10 years, I want to be doing work that I'm excited about, that I really am engaging with, that I want to be doing, and work that I can be proud of. I think that that's, you know, any artist's dream. So I think my first goal in 10 years is I want to just keep doing it. So many people stop, and I want to make certain that this is something I do for my whole life. I want to, of course, keep teaching because it's a passion of mine. It's something that, again, I feel feeds the work. So those two things, of course, I want to still be doing in 10 years, doing work that I believe in, work that keeps me excited, still showing up in the studio every single day, and, of course, still working with students as well. And then, of course, you do hope that your audience grows, that you're continuing to show, that you continue to show in bigger and better venues. And so, of course, that's something that I hope for 10 years from now as well. But of course, my main goal is that I'm still showing up in the studio and that I'm just doing work that I love and that excites me as an artist. And of course, it's all about making certain that the work sustains itself.
Wow. Well, I'm glad we asked you that. And I just want to take a second and credit Natalie Baumgartner, who is the show's producer, for coming up with some of these really creative questions that we're asking you. And so the audience knows, you know, Carla has no idea what we're going to ask her. So she has, it is an amazing show for somebody that's put on the spot with every single question. And that's true with every show. So, you know, our artists are smart people. That's who we attract at the Clark Ewing's Fund. So I'm going to ask you a really fun question for me anyway, Carla. If you weren't an artist, what would you be?
Yeah, I'm actually kind of thrown for a loop for that because, yeah, it's hard for me to imagine. You know, I love language. I speak Italian, and I guess I'd be maybe doing something with translating or language. I really think of painting as a language, so kind of fits in with that. So something with that.
So not a lawyer.
No,
not
I don't
a
think
lawyer,
so.
Not an astronaut.
Who knows? You know, you never
there
know.
There you go. I'd be a lawyer. I would, if I didn't do what I did for a living, I'd go right to law school. Yeah, Tommy Harvey. I'm one of the few people on earth, the 0.0001%, that really envies lawyers for what they get to do all day.
Well, whatever works.
You know, or at least the fun parts. You know, yeah, they get to talk and argue and ask people questions. It's a lot of fun. So I couldn't do this. So Carla, for now, obviously being an artist makes sense emotionally, financially, creatively. But what happens if and when it doesn't? Is there a point where you would give it up in your sort of career trajectory and readjust and do something else where just sort of doing this didn't make sense for you anymore? Or is that not really possible?
Yeah, I don't see that happening. If there's already, I mean, there's already been so many points when, you know, there's so many difficult things just in getting your training and getting galleries and kind of pushing through shows where you can give it up. And I, you know, if it wasn't working at some point, I think I'd make shift to what I'm doing so that it does work. You know, you have to me, it's just a part of who I am. So I can't really see giving up painting at this point in my career. I want to make certain that it's something that I do for my whole life. So if at any point one of those things isn't working financially, emotionally, intellectually, creatively, whatever it is, where you're getting burned out on one of those things, then you make changes to your life, you know, so that it is working. I think that that's more of what I would see happening in that regard, because it is, it's just such an important part of who I am.
So that really dovetails with your earlier answer about why you teach, what you get out of being an educator. You know, you're not saying that, well, I teach because, you know, it's sort of a backup plan to my art. Doesn't sound like there's a backup plan to your art. You're not saying I teach because, you know, I don't intend to make a career out of art and make a viable working business out of it. So is it viable? Does your art financially sustain you fully, or is the education really required, or is the education purely something you do because you're passionate about that too?
Mm-hmm. So the answer depends on the year that I'm having. There are some years where my art sustains me. And there are some years where I'm working, you know, I'm building up to a show when it's maybe half of my income or something, right? So the teaching, while it's not something that I do to, it's a backup plan, as you mentioned, that is a nice little side effect of it, that it does liberate me to be able to take my time because I work quite slowly. I do very traditional painting, so there's really no shortcuts. It just takes time. So I do like that. Again, I have a little bit of that freedom because of my teaching job to take the time that it takes to do these very kind of intricate paintings and take the time that they need. That is a very nice side effect where I do have the freedom to put as much into my work as I want to without having to think, is this going to sell right away? Or I can take the time to find the right audience. I can take the time to find the right gallery. So it depends on the year. And it's somewhat unpredictable. Some years, yes, where I would just be able to survive on my painting sales, and some years where I'm happy to again have that teaching job. But that's not why I teach, as I mentioned before.
Oh, I really, really like that answer because, you know, there are people that I think would throw stones at that and say, well, you know, if you're really serious about your art, just do that. Or if you're serious about any given profession, just do that. And yet, you know, in this era with the rise of sort of the gig economy and, you know, the return of the independent professional, the mom and pop shop becoming a nation of shopkeepers, this whole trend that we're seeing, so many people are sort of leaving their day jobs. And what's funny about that is if you go all in at once, if you just dump the day job and say, I'm going to be a self-sustaining business, it really limits your choices. You have limited capital. You don't necessarily get to build the better mousetrap. You have to build the better mousetrap for right now. And so one of the things I'm writing a lot about is companies and professionals that decide to keep two irons in the fire because it frees them up to make more judicious business decisions in both categories. So an artist who teaches and has an independent source of income can very often make choices that are more of the long game. You know, I'm going to invest in this art right now, even though it's not going to fly off the shelf tomorrow, but I'm going to build a brand and I'm going to build a body of work that is distinctive, that's something I believe in a way that's going to have a long-term sustainable effect. So I think there's an actual strategic, if I may say so, Carla, I think there's an actual strategic brilliance in what you're doing. I think it exemplifies some of the best practices I've seen in every aspect of business strategy. So, wow, congratulations on that. And really powerful show. So I'm going to ask you one last question before we finish today. And that's, what's next for you, like in the immediate short-term future? Just got done with some things. What are you doing next?
What's next? Well, it's actually finals week at the Academy of Art in San Francisco, so I'm doing final critiques tomorrow, and then I have about a month break where I'm just going to hit the studio hard. So again, it's kind of this seasonal thing where I've been working with students, and now I get some time to just delve into the studio. So finishing up a bunch of projects. I often have a bunch of paintings that I'm working on at the same time, which is the case right now, and I'm just so looking forward to using this next month to kind of wrapping up a lot of those paintings. And it's a really fun way to work, to have all these paintings kind of side by side. If I feel stuck in one area, I can move on to the next painting, kind of develop that where I want it to be, and then let that one sit for a little bit so I can look at it. So that's where I'm going in the next month. I'm finishing up things, starting to again pull this big project together where I'm bringing this whole group of paintings hopefully into a cohesive show. And yeah, that's where I'm going with the future. And then we start again in the fall with teaching. So I'll be doing again part of the time in the studio, part of the time teaching. So that's really where I'm going with the future. I'm looking forward to bringing this project home to completion.
Really fantastic having you on the show. You've been listening to the Thriving Artist Podcast, a feature of the Clark Hulings Fund for Visual Artists. For more information on Carla Crawford, visit carlacrawford.com. For more information on the Clark Hulings Fund and our Business Accelerator Program, visit clarkhulingsfund.org. And be sure and follow our podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Thank you for listening, and thank you, Carla. It's really been a pleasure having you.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thank you so much.